Ladies and gentlemen, are you ready for Banal of America
of America Audio with your host, Tim Banal.
No commercials, no subscriptions, no network, no rules, and at the end of the day, my friends, no comparison. And tonight on the program, no borders, because we're traveling down to Mexico City to welcome back my buddy. He's an astute observer of the esoteric, and one of the more perceptive pundits in the world of the paranormal. That's kind of how I like to describe him. And I've had the chance to hang out with him now a couple times at a couple of these paramania gatherings. And he has a very calming presence, I find. It's very nice to be around someone who has sort of there's a wisdom coming from him that you can sense in person. It's palpable, and I've really grown to love the guy over the last few years as we've become closer friends, and I knew I had to get him on here for season 10 because, as I said, the last few guests, if there's a theme emerging here of the last few episodes, it's sort of like these are friends of mine who I think are doing outstanding work, like Josh Cutchin and Aaron Goulias and our tonight's guest, Red Pill Junkie. So follow these folks because, you know, I don't know what the hell I'll be doing after we wrap up season 10. So here's some other people to check out and follow and learn from, and who I give the stamp of approval to. And Red Pill Junkie is definitely one of those guys. He writes for the Daily Grail. He writes for Mysterious Universe. He was part of the Robbie Graham Collaborative that came out in May. And he writes all over the place. He appears on a whole bunch of podcasts. And as I said, I had the chance to meet him a couple times over the last few years since we had him on the show. And I've just been blown away by everything about him, so I think he's a great guy. So welcome back to the show, Red Pill, and thanks for being a part of the final season here, man.
Well, that soothingness comes from the Spanish fly that I pour on people's drinks, you know. Oh, wait, are we live yet? Damn!
Uh-oh. Oh,
yeah, man. It's great to be back to Banal of America.
Well, it's great to have you, man. As I said, I think you're one of those. I mean, you've been around for a few years now, so you're not really like an emerging voice, but you're sort of like, well, I find interesting in a sense is, now you have the website Absurd by Design, but that, you don't necessarily sort of have a hub. You kind of float around. You're kind of like a wandering gypsy of the paranormal at different sites and stuff.
Yeah, I'm just a carny, you know, going from town to town to trying to make a living. That is perfect. Look, my website, and thanks for mentioning it.
Of course.
Absurd by Design. Yeah, it came out not as a necessity to have a place to speak my mind, because that was already covered with the Daily Grail, which is, you know, I think my main hub.
Yeah.
You know, it is, even though it's not owned by me, it's owned by Greg Taylor, my friend and mentor, you know, the guy who like opened the doors for me to this wacky world of the 4chan blogosphere, you know. And from there, it happened very organically. It happens always very organically, doesn't it? You start to connect with people in this, you know, web, in this, social networks, I guess, the way to call it, you know. And from there, I met you, I met Greg Bishop. I also connected with the guys from Mysterious Universe, who also asked me to become one of their contributors. I also was a contributor to Scotty Roberts' blog, that, you know, it's not around anymore, the one that he, like, launched back in the days of the Paradigm Symposium, and the Intrepid blog was, and also contributed with Robbie Graham before he got his first book out, you know, Silver Screen Saucers. Before that, he had this blog in which he invited people to write guest articles, and also, you know, tried to contribute there. And, you know, it was wonderful. I didn't feel the need to you know, have another, like, outlet.
Yeah.
But Absorbed by Design, I guess, in the end, I guess you do need to have your own personal website, like a main hub of activity, you know, a place that'll say, okay, you know, here, I'm the master and commander of this own vessel, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, sometimes it's more work than it's worth. So you might have cracked the code in a way, you know, because then
exactly.
You start pressuring yourself. You know, it's like, well, this is my thing, so I gotta do something that's gonna freak people out or whatever, or blow their fucking minds. And it's like, Jesus, I'm killing myself here. So, now one thing and I'm sure you probably have been on some shows and talked about this, but I haven't heard what you had to say about this, but I guess this is not the DeLong thing. I actually want to know what was it like, and is everything okay? Relatively, let us know what's going on with the earthquake. It's amazing in a way that there was this huge earthquake in Mexico City, and now it's like, you know, there was just so many disasters that people like forget almost. It's kind of scary in a way. It's like the people in Puerto Rico are in really rough shape, and California half burned to the ground or whatever, and it's like, people forget there was this huge, devastating earthquake in Mexico City. So I guess, what was that like being there, and sort of what's the scene like now? Are things starting to come back together again?
It's an interesting question, and yeah, because it's almost, more than a month after the September 19th quake happened. I was doing some work. You know, I was in front of my computer when I felt the tremor, and, you know, being a citizen of Mexico, you are used to earthquakes all of your life. You know, you felt a lot of all of your life. In fact, the previous earthquake that hit us this year, that happened in August, I was in my bed, and people started tweeting me and say, "Oh, are you okay?" And I was, dude, but I barely felt that one. You know, by the time I say, should I do something? It was over,
yeah.
Right? But this one was definitely different. You know, the whole place where I was started to shook up. The window started to creak in the most horrible way possible. And the fact that I'm not near the downtown area, right?
Yeah.
You know, so the place where I live, you usually don't feel earthquakes as strongly as if you were closer to the center of the city, you know, because of the topographical, you know, distribution of Mexico City or whatever. You know, one has to remind that right now Mexico City, which is probably the biggest city in the continent, was built on top of what was a lake, you know, 500 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, now the lake was dried out. But it's still, you know, it's still very unstable ground, and that's why the reason why earthquakes are felt so strongly in the city, and that's also one of the reasons why, in this occasion, it was 7.1 earthquake. I think that the one from August was even stronger, but the epicenter of this one was way closer to to the city. And what is one of the reasons why we once again experience the collapse of buildings the same way that it happened back in 1985. And back in 1985, I was 12 years old. You know, I was still in grade school. You know, I was about to start junior high. And, you know, as a kid, you feel that, and it's kind of surreal. And then you saw the destruction on TV. You know, all the buildings that collapse and all the rubble, and it's kind of surreal, but once again, you feel it when you're an adult, and it's, I don't know, it's a whole new dimension. It's, in a way, it's kind of like important, Tim. I don't know if I should say this, but I think that, in a way, it's important to have this reminder us of just how fragile and how, you know, that we're mortal beings, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I think many of us felt that. But one of the great things that happened because of the earthquake is once again we saw the citizens of Mexico rising up to the occasion and doing all they could to try to help those in need, particularly among the 20-year-olds, you know, or people who are in high school or their early 30s, the millennials, right?
Yeah.
And we have this stereotype of the millennials being with their nose buried on their phones, are not really caring much about the state of the world and politics and all of that. You know, we feel them to be closed or isolated in their own bubble.
Right.
But I have to tell you, they really taught us on that occasion that they, when the right time comes, they can be just as full of solidarity and just as willing to risk it all, you know, to try to help people in need. It really gave those of us who are in our 40s, you know, people who are, you know, middle-aged, a lot of hope for the future of this country, because if that energy can be some kind of endured or preserved, you know, there's really no telling what this generation could do for the benefit of this country. In fact, that is kind of like the things that we are starting to regret right now. Like, things are quote-unquote calming down. Like, people are no longer on the streets trying to be on those raids or trying to bring food to the survivors of the catastrophe, or trying
right.
to go and leap up the debris or clean up the rubble. I guess people went back home and they're like now like of expecting the government to do their part. But like you said, it's correct. You know, people tend to numb down and to like go into this lethargy very quickly nowadays, and now we're forgetting that there's still people out there who have literally no place to live because
they lost
their home.
Yeah.
And like you said, it's not only in Mexico, it's in Puerto Rico, like only 50% of people, if I'm correct, have electricity. It's terrible. And what's happening in California, I don't know, I think we are so, I guess maybe it's the problem with our instant access to technology. We're so bombarded so constantly with all these developments all around the world that it's very difficult to cope with it. And maybe one of the things that people cope with it is that, you know, you get kind of detached and like saying, well, you know, okay, so Puerto Rico, sucks to be them, you know. I'm not living there. I don't know anyone there. So what can I do? And one of the things is that, you know, we are seeing all these disasters, and whether they're happening more frequently or not, it's up to debate. I don't think so. I think that's what's happening is that we are more aware of them nowadays.
Right. Yeah, we're seeing them more. Yeah.
Exactly. But we need that kind of reminding of hey, next time it could really happen to you, because this is a living planet. You know, some people were saying that, you know, the all these hurricanes and by the way, there was a hurricane or a tropical storm that was going towards Ireland. It's like,
yeah,
what?
I saw that. Yeah, it's really weird. Yeah, I try not to like worry too. The only thing I got like spooked by the Mexican earthquake briefly, because it was like right when that guy had predicted. Like, it was, like, really close to September 23rd. It was, like, right after the hurricanes, and there was this huge earthquake. And, like, for like, half a day, I was kind of like, I wonder if that guy's right. Like, I wonder if Planet X really is about to sweep in and mess up this planet. But, yeah, it's just weird. I think, in a way, I mean, you're probably right that it's just this natural thing. But you almost wonder, in a sense, like, how you were saying, like, we need these kind of things. I agree. And it's almost like you wonder if there's some larger message in the madness of it all, where
sure.
It's like you would think technology, like it's supposed to be, oh, technology has made us all connected, or, you know, that thing should be easy. It's like, well, here's some challenges for you, you know, humans or Earth or whatever. It's like here's like several massive hurricanes and a disastrous earthquake and wildfire, like all at the same time. You know, I mean, forget all the turmoil, like politics and everything. It's like maybe there's another part where could this like just angst, this collective angst, be manifesting itself in the weather or something? Who knows? You know.
Well, you know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, right?
Yeah.
But on the same having said that, I don't think that is so that outrageous to assume that nuclear testings could have some kind of impact on the planet, right? I mean, we do know that one way to detect a nuclear test from nations like North Korea is through seismometers.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
They literally cause earthquakes. And we think, okay, so that is a localized phenomenon, right? Or it's a localized impact. But we have to remind ourselves, you know, nature is about connectedness. Everything is connected to everything. So that is the thing with our planet. So we don't know if blasting a bomb on the South Pacific, you know, can have a large impact.
Ripple effect. Yeah.
Ripple effect, exactly. And maybe that, you know, if we want to go speculating and starting to talk about UFOs, it was one of the reasons why those wacky contactees started to receive all these messages from the Space Brothers, right? And saying, hey, you guys, you're starting to mess with these nuclear things, and, you know, maybe it's not really such a great idea.
Yeah, that's one of the prevalent theories, it seems, about UFOs or the modern UFO era, let's say, that, like, they started showing up, right around when we started tinkering with all this nuclear stuff. So,
or even before, right? I mean, one of the a recent article that I published for Mysterious Universe, what this really fascinating story that was first published on this classical book, Morning of the Magicians, by Louis Powell and Jacques Vergier. It was released in 1968. And it talks about Jacques Vergier. He was a chemical engineer, but was also fascinated with alchemy. And he relates the story that in the 1930s, before the start of the Second World War, he allegedly had an encounter with a mysterious man who never gave his name or identity, but he warned him. He warned about research into nuclear energy because it could have disastrous implications for humanity. And this guy apparently was someone who professed to know about the ancient art of alchemy. And alchemy, everybody thinks that it was, you know, just a bunch of weird old men in the Middle Ages trying to turn lead into gold, right? You know, that's the cliche stereotype. But the fact is that alchemy is a really, really ancient practice. In fact, we don't know how old it is. We have only a few hints about it. I mean, the name itself, Al-Kemet, which is Arabic, Kemet means Egypt. So apparently this science can at least be linked back to ancient Egypt. And if you go the whole Von Däniken or Graham Hancock Avenue, then maybe the people from Egypt received those sacred principles from a previous civilization, right? Now we're talking about, you know, Atlantis and all of those things. But getting back to the story, you know, this guy said, you know, he warned Vergier, you know, that trying to research into nuclear energy was very dangerous, because with a few ounces of matter turning into energy, you could destroy a whole city. And let's remember that this was before the release of the bombs in Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Right.
You know, before we really learned about how powerful the atomic weapons could be, before the detonations in the Trinity's test sites, the scientists who were working in the Manhattan Project, they really didn't know how powerful the blast will be. You know, they ran bets about it. I mean, some were really serious in worrying that they could start a chain reaction that could put the whole atmosphere of the planet on fire, you know?
It's interesting, yeah. It makes you think about, like, that whole thing with CERN where people were like, when they turn it on, it's going to open a black hole. It's going to eat the planet. It's like, it's kind of the same idea in a way.
And that's one of the things that these alleged alchemists told Verger, that in ancient times there were people who had managed to gather a lot of advanced knowledge, but they were kind of endowed with this high sense of morality, you know, about the research, and that's why they tried to keep it secret.
Yeah.
And, you know, there is the idea that alchemy was the only science with conscience. And what you see now in modern science is like kind of like the things that the character of Ian Malcolm tells in the Jurassic Park movie. You know, the idea that, yeah, if you can have this great scientific breakthrough just because you can, but shouldn't you consider if you should? And the idea nowadays is, no, if you can do it, you better do it first, otherwise somebody else will.
Mm-hmm.
It's the thing that we now hear with the development of artificial intelligence.
Yeah,
like
exactly,
Yeah, a lot of people worry about it, you know, Elon Musk, Stephen Hawking, all of that, like, hey, this is dangerous stuff. But at the same time, the people who are developing it is, okay, yeah, it is dangerous stuff, but if we don't develop it first, our enemies will, and then we will have this AI gap. It's kind of like the sequel
race
to Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah, it's freaky. It's weird. I mean, I'm not one of those people that tends to worry about the AI thing, because in a sense, it's like, I think it'll miss us.
It would happen after we die?
Yeah, I think any like really bad thing will happen like after after we die. Like at the end of the century, maybe that's when they'll be like, all right, we've gone too. This is a run amok. I know that like they think it's going to happen really fast, but it's like as I grow older, I've been doing this show for like 13 years. It's like a lot of the stuff we worried about back when we first started the show is like, it hasn't happened, but it's kind of happened, and it's like we've managed to sort of, like, adapt to the things we feared, you know? Because, like, I always point out on the show, like, the whole – back when I first got into this, it was like, oh, they're going to put microchips in everyone and shit. And I've said on the show over the years, it's like, they did. They gave us phones, dude. Like,
we
have the phones. We willingly took the chip and just put it in our pocket instead of putting it in our hand. But it's like 99% of the time in your fucking hand anyway. Most of the, you know, we credited the young people, but it's like they're the ones who've been brainwashed the most about these things. So, you know, they've been roped in the hardest on these things. But it's like, so the chip is real. The chip is out there. It's just like everybody has it in the form of a phone, you know. And it's funny because people, it used to be, the thing would be like, you're not going to be able to go to the store without the phone. You're not going to be able to, I mean, without the chip. You're not going to, you know, you can't buy and sell without the chip and all this stuff. And it's like, kind of is that. It's like anyone who doesn't have a cell phone is like, is completely disconnected from the fabric of society now, like, just by the nature of how it's enveloped everything.
Yeah, you know that Mark Zuckerberg is going to rule the world eventually, because even your grandmother is in Facebook, you know. Even your granny was, hey, how do you send a message to your auntie Bertha there with this gluey, you know, the blue window? And yeah, you're right. People, it's funny, you know. being a Mexican, I'm kind of like an outsider of the people in the United States, you know, in conspiracy groups and whatever. And I probably, one of the reasons why I'm so, in a way, immune to the paranoia that is so prevalent in those groups.
It's true, because, yeah, you know, I didn't think of that. Yeah, yeah, a lot of the, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, they're so worried, I mean, and not, I'm not saying it's not justifiable, they're so worried about their loss of privacy, right? But at the same time, millennials and generation, I think that the first generation who has lived all your life with digital devices are just, you know, getting into high school, you know?
Yeah.
And for those generations, you know, to be in front of a camera all the time is completely normal. It's like, yeah, sure, why not? I mean, are you crazy? Imagine if for them it's unbelievable, the idea of, hey, you can be in a room without, you know, electronic gadgets, and that without anybody knowing what you're doing. And it's, shut up, you know. And they are tweeting or Instagramming whatever they are doing right now, you know,
yeah,
the food they're taking or where they are. And there are some aspects about that that are scary. There are some aspects about that that maybe could be beneficial in the long term. But one thing's for sure, you know, 10 years or 20 years from now, the idea about, you know, privacy and the idea about personal freedom is going to change a lot. It's going to be very different from what we, you know, consider to be normal. And because one thing that I also think is happening is that the world is really speeding up in some instances. You know, in some things it stayed the same, but in other aspects it's really like revving up. Like if you go to college nowadays, you know, and you go 5 years to try to attain a diploma, and the United States, you know, it's a really crappy proposition, because then you get a huge debt that you have to pay for the next 20, 15 years or whatever.
Yeah, and it's like even worse, because now they gave out so many loans and everything to rope all those people in that now they've diluted the value of the four-year degree. So now people are have to go and get a master's degree if they want to, you know, because the kid at McDonald's has a four-year degree. It's like, what? Yeah.
Yeah, it's a crappy position, because you have to work for pay for 20 years, a piece of paper that only will probably be useful for 5 or 10 years at the most. You know, because the world keeps changing, because the job industry or the job market is also in constant evolution, and the professions that are profitable nowadays, maybe not so, you know, in the very near future. I was watching a video on YouTube about this, I don't know, conference that was held by Adobe, you know, the company that creates the or has the rights for the Photoshop software, you know, which is kind of like the industry standard for photo retouching and also video editing. And they were showing their new applications, and it was truly amazing. These guys were basically, with just a few buttons, totally manipulating a picture. Like, you have three persons walking around on a park, and you want to get rid of those persons, no problem. You just click one button and they're gone.
Yeah.
And you can even replace them for other people. And let's talk about, you know, what that implicates for people who still think that UFOs can be proven with video or with graphic evidence. You know, let's just forget about that. But not only that, but, you know, someone who tried to make a living out of that photo retouching is going to lose their job, you know, very quickly.
Yeah, well, what I was thinking as you were talking about that is the idea, like, that kind of what I said, where it's like it's going to be a while. I think that the people, whoever's developing this technology, in a sense, it's, I hope, and I like to think that they are sort of anticipating the problem that they're going to create as it gets more sophisticated, with the idea that, like, there's all this talk of oh, they're going to have, you know, self-driving transportation trucks, you know. So, like, all the truckers are going to lose their jobs, and it's like they're developing robots to do, you know, to work at McDonald's and stuff. And it's like all those people are going to – it's like, what are they going to do about all these – what are they going to have people do if we replace everything with robots? And I don't think – like, that's why I think it's going to be a really slow process where – you know, but we're going to look up, at, you know, as we're old men and be like, well, you know, they got by, they survived the whole trucker crisis when they replaced them, but we'll see what they do now that they've replaced all the firefighters with robots or whatever. You know what I'm saying? It's like, it's like we'll sort of be at the stage where it's like, we're getting old. We'll be like, this might become a problem, but luckily I think we'll be out of the picture by then. Who knows?
I don't know. I'm not so sure anymore. I mean, I don't want to get personal. I'm 44 years old, and I'm basically out of the job market here in Mexico because of what I do. You know, because I have to compete with people that are 20 years younger, and they're willing to earn a third of what I used to.
Yeah.
You know, and work, you know, two or three extra hours per day. You know, and I used to work, you know, 12 hours a day. So what I think it could happen, Tim, and I've listened to people discuss this more and more frequently, is the idea of universal income.
Yeah,
the idea of paying people just for being, you know, alive and breathing.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Let me just stop you quick. Does this sound better now? You sent me a message, very professionally sent me a private message, and now I'm going to go unprofessional and ask, is the sound better now? Am I coming in clearer than I was before?
It's the same. It's like every time you start talking very rapidly, it starts to break.
Really? Weird. All right. Anyone
right
in the
now, like now, with that tone, that speed, it's fine.
All right, I'll try and slow down. People in the chat room, are we having any sound problems? They'll let us know. See, dude, technology. It's supposed to make things easier, but it doesn't. I tend to move around a lot. Maybe I'll just try and stay in one place.
So we're talking about universal income. You think it couldn't work?
I don't know. No, I don't know. Where are they going to get the money from?
Like from the people who have, you know, trillions of dollars, and they won't be able to spend it, even if they lived 1,000 lifetimes. Although, if those guys manage to get the secret of immortality, then I guess we're all screwed.
Yeah, the money would have to come from the people with the robots that replace all the stuff, right?
Yeah,
I mean, so
and they will be willing to give it away. Otherwise, you know, they will have to go to, I don't know, Iceland or some other, you know, remote island, and or maybe, you know, Mars, if you want to go that way, and stay there out of fear of all the, you know, the plebs that they left behind. You know, it's like the movie Elysium.
Yeah.
You know, in which you have the one percenters basically living above everyone else, literally, because they live in a space station in which they have all these wonderful medical technologies that keep them cancer-free and wrinkle-free, you know, and diabetes-free and fat-free for the rest of their lives. Meanwhile, the rest of the world looks like, you know, Ciudad Juarez.
Yeah, because they have to... If the whole idea is like they replaced all the truck drivers with trucks that drive across the country, it's like that they're delivering stuff that people have to buy. So it's like people have the whole system relies on people buying stuff essentially.
Yep.
So it's like if they don't have the money to buy stuff, then you don't have the money to send the trucks around.
Yeah,
like, so
exactly.
There needs to be some kind of balance there. But I don't quite think they have that figured out yet, I guess, is the idea, you know.
No, capitalism never has that figured out. Capitalism is about perennial growth, you know, and the problem is that there cannot be perennial growth on a closed environment, an environment with finite resources. And obviously there has been endless discussion about this. You know, there was this guy, Malthus, and the idea that, you know, by the early 20th century, there was going to be so many people in the planet that there wouldn't be any more food for them. You know, there was this. So there was this. I think the term is Malthusian, you know, catastrophe. But then the people who rebuke those ideas, they claim that technology eventually has a way around it. And in the case of food, by the 1960s, there was a revolution in agriculture. You know, there were people who created technologies that they also taught to countries of the third world, like in Mexico and India, and that managed to create a boom of food that kind of like prevented that. You know, that the idea that there was going to be this overpopulation crisis, you know, and then there was all these birth control measurements that countries started to try to enact by the 1970s, trying to reduce the number of births. But also, like you said, you know, that also causes some other problems. Like, for example, there are literally nations in Europe and even in Japan in which they will soon have more senior citizens, more people that are over 60 years old than people that are, 18 years old.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So, in Japan, they have, like, a big problem there.
Yeah, and that causes a problem, like saying, okay, who is going to take care for those elderly? And Japan, instead of saying, yeah, well, we'll just invite people from other nations to come here and take care of our elderly, they say, screw that, we're going to build robots.
Yeah, they love the robots. Yeah, they love
to wipe their ass of granny, yeah.
Yeah. Well, to be honest, that's a good job for a robot. You know, I don't wiping grandma's ass is it's the kind of thing you would want to develop a machine to do. Come on.
Well, yeah, there are things like, yeah, and for example, war, right?
I think that maybe in 20
years, wars will be fought by robots, you know, for the developed nations. Well, the rest of the nations, they will still have to be, battling the robots. And that's going to create all these kind of ethical conundrums or whether, you know, should you let the robots to have autonomy to pull the trigger or not? It's going to be complicated, and I really feel, Tim, it's going to come sooner than we realize, because it always with the future, it always happens. It always catches us, you know, with our pants down.
That's for sure. Yeah. Well, I suppose a lot of my stance is wishful thinking, in a sense, where it's like I don't want to deal with with robots but in a way, I think you're right, because we're already sort of talking about this transition where it's like they're talking about this truck thing being an inevitability, and it's like the whole idea of like war and robots is already kind of playing out with the drones thing, where it's like, are we ethically, what are the ethics involved here? We can just run these like we can, you know, what the Germans did to the British, or the Blitz. You know, we could develop a way to just blitz someplace with thousands of drones dropping and no one, and not lose a single American. You know, so it's like, what's the I guess that's war, though. If you strive to have the better weapons, right? But it's kind of like at what cost, man?
Yeah, well, let's go back to Morning of the Magicians. The authors of that book, they argue how there was a time when technological advancement, you know, just for the sake of trying to have the upper hand against your enemy, was kind of like looked down or restricted. There was actually this pope in medieval times who enacted a prohibition against the tripods that the archers using longbows, they could use these tripods to try to kind of like balance the weapon and try to, you know, because they are very heavy, right? But the Pope decided that those tripods would give the archers an unfair and inhuman advantage against their enemies.
Yeah.
So for 200 years in Europe, those tripods were banned.
Interesting. Wow. All right. Maybe not. This is going to be like we're going into kooky conspiracy realm, but it's like maybe that's. We always talk. It always frustrates me in a sense when they talk about how the government has all these like UFO technology, but maybe it's like this stuff's too advanced. It's not fair if we could take over the world if we just use the UFOs we have in our possession, but it's not. It's not a good idea to do or something, you know.
Yeah, it's an interesting philosophical conundrum because I'm really, you know, 20 years ago it was so certain that the United States was in fact reverse engineering UFO technology, you know, back when I was reading the Groom Lake Desert Rat and reading about Area 51 and Bob Lazar. And there was this other guy, J-Rod, who claimed to have been an engineer in Area 51 who met, you know, the gray aliens that were teaching the United States how to pilot these UFOs and all of that. Nowadays, I'm more skeptical of that story. But, yeah, I mean, let's say that they do have, you know, one or two UFOs, you know, and even if they know how to operate them, and maybe it doesn't cost like $1 trillion just to take that flying saucer for a spin for 10 minutes, you know, let's say they could say, okay, you know, we can use that flying saucer and, I don't know, phaser Kim Jong-un out of existence, you know in 10 seconds or less. And finish with our whole crisis, but yeah, but what are the implications of that? Because it's the same thing that the genie out of the bottle that happened with nuclear energy. I mean, 20 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the Russians said, or even less than 20 years, the Russians said, "Hey, guess what? We have the bomb too." And when everybody noticed just how relatively easy it is to build these things, they started to try to replicate and to try to have one of their own. And we are now into this insane race in which the United States still has the largest stick, in which say, yeah, you can have it, but you can't, you know, and that you that can't are Iran and North Korea, Iraq back in the day, but you know those who can are Israel and France and Great Britain and Germany. And it's there was someone in a podcast who was saying, well, you know, maybe everybody should have a nuclear weapon because then we will really have that assured total destruction, you know, that was kind of like was the basis of the Cold War stalemate. But I don't know if that is the solution, because to me that is kind of like equating the NRA utopia of having everybody, even a child, you know, being armed with a gun every time you walk down the street.
Yeah,
and,
I
don't want to live in that world.
Yeah, it's like one of those standoffs where you're like shooting everybody else. It's like, it's, it's too much. Because part of me worries about like local skirmishes, but then at the same time, it's like India and Pakistan have nukes, and that was the thing that everybody was worried about. So maybe once the country gets it, then they realize the power. But it only takes this one lunatic idiot to mess it all up. So
mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's a very tenuous. tenuous situation to be a part of, I think. So, yeah, it's probably not a great idea.
And I'm still open to the idea that in ancient past, there were civilizations who managed to develop technologies similar in destructive power to nuclear weapons. And they blew themselves up. And, you know, we don't have any remnants for that because... you know, our constructions are really very fragile. You know, there are those programs, TV programs, which show how, you know, if the human race was wiped out, like, tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, I love those shows.
Yeah, New York City will be, you know, completely devastated and full of, you know, trees and stuff.
Lions and tigers and shit. Yeah, they really.
Yeah, in 10, 20 years, you know, and
yeah.
And in 50 years, you know, the Empire State will collapse, you know, and by 100 years, probably nothing will stand, you know.
Yeah. Well, let's hope that's not the case. How is the sound now since we switched everything over and I sat down and stopped running around? Better?
It's kind of better, yeah. Yeah, but at least I can understand what you're saying.
Weird. Well, the people in the chat said it was okay, so I don't know what the hell's going on, but I got to get a new phone this weekend. Yeah, well, it makes you wonder in a sense, too, if the, you know, you're talking about, or you were telling us about the guys who tested the first bomb there. It's like it makes you, a lot of people have this idea that, like, all these ancient civilizations, maybe they went to war with each other, but maybe it was just they were trying to invent the bomb, and they... much as the people were sort of betting on what would happen, like they didn't carry the one or something in the math, and they just, you know, they were like, let's just test it right here in the middle of the city. It'll be fine. We'll just turn it on and see what happens. And then, you know, they blew up a nuke like right in the middle of Atlantis by accident. So who knows?
Yeah, exactly.
Oh,
yeah, no, I mean, and then, I mean, you see, there was this interesting TV show. Long time ago, the idea of the designers of this facility in Yucca Mountain, you know, this place where the United States wanted to dump a whole lot of radioactive waste, the thing that will still have a half-life of 50,000 years or something like that, you know. And the idea was, okay, how do you build something that first, you know, will endure all of that time, and second, we'll try to dissuade people from entering it, you know, and because if you use some kind of like warning sign with your own alphabet, well, obviously, in 50,000 years, nobody's going to read English, you know, the words will be meaningless, you know, the same thing that happens with us trying to decipher, you know, Mayan writing or even the Rongo tablets of Easter Island, right?
Yeah.
And so they came up with something in the end that looked a whole lot like a pyramid, you know? And reminded me of just how all those people who are so obsessed of trying to enter all the secret tunnels inside the Great Pyramid, because they think that they're going to get up and find the tablets from Atlantis or you know the machine left by the ancient aliens. But what if the people who built it left it closed for a very good reason?
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I tend to think like most of the good stuff's already gone from those places anyway because they've been around for thousands of years. You know. It's remarkable. I remember hearing the story that, like, I don't know if it was when they discovered it or it was, like, during a war or something, but I think it was, like, Napoleon. I'm just butchering this historical factoid, but it's all right. But Napoleon's troops, they just shot at, like, the Sphinx. They just shot at it when they first saw it. And it was like, who knows what else used to be out there that civilization just blew up and destroyed.
Sure. But then there's the
Library of Alexandria.
Yeah, actually, exactly, a good point. There's the idea, I guess, with Egypt that the ancient Egyptians or the people who preceded the Egyptians were so smart that they would make sure to bury their, you know, treasures or their knowledge until we were ready for them, you know, and that's why, you know, there's all these legends about some secret chambers beneath the paws of the Great Sphinx. This is something that, you know, the followers of Edgar Cayce were trying really, really hard to discover. And in fact, this is something that fascinated me when I first learned of it. None other than Sahih Hawass, the guy who became the great honcho of Egyptian archaeology, back in the 90s, that guy actually got a scholarship from the Edgar Casey Foundation.
Oh, wow.
Something that he has tried to deny and tried to cover all of his career because he doesn't want to be associated with that anymore. But he basically got his education in the United States because of people who were entrusting him or were trying to see if he could work or try to get a hand on finding that secret chamber.
That's weird. I never heard that before.
Oh yeah, it's part of one of the things that Robert Duvall, his dark past and this long quarrel with the likes of Robert Duvall and Robert Schock, and those are the guys who if you go to their websites, they have documented all of this and also all these troubles he had with National Geographic and corruption and the fact that he was so close to the president in Egypt that they ousted back in the days of the Arab Spring. What was the name of this guy? Hosni Mubarak.
Yes.
That's why he, in the end, kind of like fell out of grace and lost his job. I guess he's now back into the Egyptian government. I don't know if he got his old job back or not, but I think that he kind of like stepped out of it for a little while, and then I don't know. I think he's kind of like.
This is Zahi Hawass you're talking about?
Yeah, Zahi Hawass.
Yeah. He's like, I think he's like an esteemed fellow type thing, where he's not
something
the,
like that.
Something,
yeah.
Where they kind of changed his title and maybe like, he's like that pope that stepped out. but more vocal.
It's a good analogy. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting in a sense because, like, I haven't given much thought to this idea of the stuff, being, I guess, I like the idea that, like, the ancients left us stuff to figure out when it was time. Because to me, it's like, part of me wonders if it's just the universal yearning for
a golden age.
Yeah, or for, like, answers where it's like, okay, well, the aliens are going to tell us what's going on. And it's like, well, if you don't believe that, you're like, well, the Atlanteans, they knew what was going on.
Yeah.
And, I think maybe there's just something inherently like ingrained in the human condition where it's like there's answers out there to whatever these big questions are.
Yeah, totally. And also that is what fuels our ideas and even our hopes about the afterlife, the idea that, the moment that we kick the bucket, flatline, and go into that tunnel of light, we're totally going to get all of the answers to the universe that we were scratching our heads back here in this, in this rock orbiting the sun. But what if that's not the case, What if those spirits, in the fifth dimension are as clueless as we are?
I would like to hope, as crazy as it might sound, I'd like to hope that that you don't get all the answers when you die, because it would kind of be boring. Like, I hope there's like new mysteries that, like a new season of weird mysteries that grow out of the answers we receive.
Yeah, that's something that I also started to develop that ideology when I started to study the Uran material. Urantia is an alleged channeled book.
I think
it was published in the 1920s, 1930s, something like that, in the United States, and it's a whole lot of book like continuing where the Bible left off, right?
Mm.
And it talks about this whole, the real secret history of the world and the creation of the universe. And the thing that it paints to me and that I think that kind of resonates with me is the idea, number one, that this reality or this universe or what we perceive is the whole of the universe is just a tiny, tiny, tiny subset of a bigger reality. And that, I think, it's a really interesting idea. And I also kind of think that will explain a lot about phenomena like the UFOs. I feel that, in a way, UFOs are more real than us. You know, UFOs are real, whereas us and our world is the illusion. You know, that's number one. And number two, the thing that it, the concept that it showed or kind of like proposed Durante material, that after you die, yeah, you go into just another level of existence that is a little more advanced than this one. But the idea is to keep on pressing on, you know, life after life after life, and trying to attain more and more perfection, you know, and kind of like learn more and experience more of life and experience more about what's out there until, you know, there comes a time, you know, in trillions or quadrillion years from now in which you kind of like attain a godlike nature. And that kind of like thing makes sense to me, you know, as someone who was a former Catholic, but also someone who think that could also work with the idea of reincarnation, that, okay, you know, if you do well in this lifetime, okay, you may go and to reincarnate in another world, not like Earth, but a little bit, you know, better. But if you, you know, screw the pooch, no, well, you have to, you know, go and do the test once again, you know, and you go and reincarnate once again into this Earth.
Yeah. Well, I talked about this once with Paul Kimmel. We had sort of a heated conversation about it in a sense where it's like it makes me sort of like fearful that idea in a sense where it's like I just am very egocentric, and it's like you want to hold on to your own personality in a sense. You know what,
yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like, but I guess maybe once you're in the next personality, you don't care about the last one. Who knows?
Well, what is your personality, Tim? I mean, what do you think constitutes you?
I guess like the cumulative experiences and morals and that kind of thing.
Sure.
Dislikes, I guess.
Okay, but let me put you an example, you know. You go to bed and you go and dream. Do you have do you dream?
Rarely.
All right. But you have dreamed in the past.
Yes. Yeah. I have dreamed before, yes.
Okay. And have you dreamed about other people or being in I don't know, like the house you grew up with or being...
Oh,
in
yeah,
the beach?
Yeah. And encountering other people that I knew and stuff
yeah.
like that, yeah.
But think about it. All those people in your dreams land... All those parts of the dream, you know, the table you sit beside and or the house you are inhabiting, they are all parts of you. They are parts of your own mind. It's just that you are not, you don't think they are part of you. You are in a way disconnected from them, but they are part of you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So where do you start, where do you begin, and where do you end?
I see what you're saying, yeah. That's deep. This is the wisdom I was talking about, folks. The wisdom of Red Pill Junkie. It just exudes. I don't know. Yeah. Well, that calms me down somewhat about about the afterlife. But then, yeah. But at the same time, it's like I see what you're saying. We are all interconnected. Who knows where it all begins and ends?
Yeah. Well, there was this alchemist, and I think you will notice that right now I'm kind of like obsessed with alchemy once again. You know, I think that there's something there that maybe we should look up more. But there was this guy, you know, this natural philosopher, I guess it was the term back in the day, Fascius Cardan. And this guy kind of like made the rites, and I guess he drew a pentagram in his laboratory, and he invoked some ethereal beings, sylphs, right? You know, elementals. And I think seven of them appeared. Three of them were, I guess, the principals. And he started to ask them questions about the nature of God and the nature of the world. And when one of the answers that he got is, when he, one of the questions that he made was, okay, how did God create the world? And one of them said, well, you know, just God, you know, created the world and that's that. And another one kind of like contradicted the first and said, no, God is creating the world moment to moment. And if God ceased to think about the world for just one moment, the whole world will cease to exist. And this is something, Tim, that was written in the 1600s or something like that.
Oh, wow.
You know, hundreds of years ago. And in a way, it perfectly matches with our current of the standard understanding of quantum physics and the observer effect. The idea that nothing really exists by itself. It has to be observed by or it has to be experienced by a consciousness.
Yeah.
And you know, that kind of like goes with the whole Zen koan of if there's someone clapping their hands in the forest, but there was no one there to listen to it,
right.
The sound exists or not. And the other thing that this guy, Fascius Cardan, received, the knowledge they received from these beings, was the idea that when a person, nothing of the person remains after they die. And, okay, so that you could interpret it as saying, okay, so you die and, you know, you are, that is the total annihilation of your being, right? But it could also be that the aspects that you were talking about, that you treasure the most, your memories of, you know, your friends, the places you visited, you know, your favorite food, your favorite movies, those things that you cherish, you think that constitute yourself, those things are lost once you die. But there's another aspect of you, your higher self, by using the parlance of mystics, that endures and moves on into maybe another cycle of rebirth.
Yeah.
And that, in a way, it's concordant with what people like Dr. Ian Stephens started to study with regards to children that remember their past reincarnations. The idea that, okay, so there's this consciousness that is moving around from life after life, and these children, they tend to remember snippets of their past lives, but sooner or later that thing goes away, and the children, you know, moves on into their new existence. But does that mean that the child or that self from the child was annihilated once he died? No, it just means that it's kind of like cosplaying, maybe, you know. You are cosplaying into a character, you know, in a given narrative, and once this movie is over, you know, you go and interpret a different role, but it's the same actor.
Yeah, that's an interesting way of putting it. Yeah, I never thought of it that way, yeah. Well, we'll see. Now, what do you think of this idea? Because I was, I switched phones again, so if you start, just speak up.
Yeah, that is perfect now, yeah.
All right, we'll see if this one holds up better. What do you think of this whole idea? Because I was sort of reading an opinion piece about this, and it stems from what we've been talking about here. Like, that just that you take the technology we're talking about and how it's kind of dangerous and growing, and the idea of, like, the ultimate quest is to stop death, right? Isn't that, like, the ultimate human quest?
Yeah.
Like, at some point, there's a possibility, there's a chance. I mean, much like the trucker thing, I think maybe I don't know how I feel about whether I want to be around when this happens. But they're talking about someday being able to take your zeitgeist, your zest, or whatever, like what we're talking about, and save it, and say, you know, and you won't die.
Yeah.
I guess, like, there's a million ways to go down in that idea where it's like, I don't know if that's a good idea or not. And who knows? It freaks me out in a way, but I think it's almost bound to happen. And it's like, we haven't really thought through the consequences of that. Who are we, what makes you any better than, like, your grandfather? Like, everyone should die, right? I think, I don't know.
Yeah. I remember there was this, episode on Star Trek: The Next Generation, in which there was this planet that the Enterprise goes to, and there was this scientist that was doing a lot of. He was researching the star of that planet because it was going to go into supernova, you know, very soon, and he was trying to find, you know, an answer to that. But that particular society, dictated by, you know, people after they reach a certain age, let's say 60 years old, they had to be euthanized. You know, it was nothing personal. It just was the way of their society, you know. But the guy was about to have go into a breakthrough, but he was, you know, he had reached that age. But he needed to continue his work, right?
Mm-hmm.
And there was this moral dilemma, you know. Should he go and renounce to his culture and go into exile aboard the Enterprise to continue his work, or should he, you know, allow himself to die and let others carry on and admit that he himself was not that important? And obviously this is a very difficult question, because I've heard people who argue or who make a case for these life extension technologies. They always say something like, you know, imagine if Albert Einstein had lived 20 years more, you know, the things that he could have found, you know, maybe, you know, we could have, I don't know, anti-gravity technology right now, something like that, you know. That it's always the same idea, you know, and kind of like, in a way, it's the same moral dilemma that people say, well, imagine if Mozart's parents had, you know, decided to have an abortion. And it's kind of like impossible to answer. It's very rhetorical, but it's used to try to make a case for or against a certain topic. So I don't know. I mean, I think that it would be nice, obviously, to live longer. But then again, you know, why do you need to those extra years, you know? What will you use them for? Some people say, well, you know, if I could live to be 200, I would go back to school, and I could go and travel the world. And then you could say, well, why aren't you doing it now?
Yeah,
why are
yeah.
you waiting for, you
yeah.
know? I mean, but people who... There was something I read recently in the Mexican newspaper, the idea that in Mexico we have effectively extended the lifespan of our population by, I don't know, 10 years or so. But the problem is that those years are really not good years for those people. Those years are lived in infirmity. So they're also expanding the sickness. So if the idea is to just extend life, you know, just for the sake of it, I don't know if that's the case. And I also think that there's also some things that are said in sci-fi stories, you know. One of the things that make life precious is that it has an end, you know. Things that are endless, they're not valued as much as things that have a beginning and have an end.
That's true,
you know?
Yeah.
So there are those things that we also have to take into consideration. I also imagine the idea that if they manage to actually achieve life-extending technologies, you know, that maybe the only thing that would terminate a person's life would be a sudden accident, then I imagine that world would be a society in which going out to the street for a walk would be considered, you know,
terrifying.
A risk sport like climbing Mount Everest.
I never thought of that, yeah. Yeah. Well, it's interesting in a sense, because we're talking about reincarnation, but it's like, what... Maybe we would disrupt the natural order of things unknowingly.
Yeah.
Where it's like all of a sudden there's some system in place that reincarnation is a part of, and it's like, what happens when the reincarnating stops because we figured out how not to die?
Mm-hmm.
Like, are we going to have the ETs come down and tell us then, like, look, at you managed to get through the nuclear bomb thing, but you've got to die at some point. You can't you can't keep living forever. We're running out of souls up here, man.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, and it will be interesting because we're always talking about disclosure, right, in our circle, you know, that I'll imagine a world.
Some people
which,
are. Yeah,
yes, obviously. Some people, they're trying to imagine a world in which we everybody knew that aliens exist. There was a movie that was released by Netflix earlier this year that is called The Discovery, and it was also a different kind of disclosure. It was a world in which life after death was conclusively proven by science.
Oh, wow.
And it was an interesting proposal, you know.
I talked about it
with Alex Sakiris because you know that he is very much advocating for, you know, the life after death, the science and all of that, near-death experiences. He hated the movie, by the way.
It's I was kind
of shocked by that. But I think that was, it wasn't like the greatest movie ever, but it was, I liked it because it posed that idea. Okay, imagine that we knew for certain that we die and that we continue, you know. Then what happens, you know? Would it be like everybody will say, oh, well, fuck it, you know. I'm going to go and eat 10 McDonald's, so who cares if I die of diabetes next year, you know? I know that I'm going to keep on going, or I know that I'm going to go on into my next reincarnation or whatever. But I guess that's not the point. I guess the point is, remember when there used to be arcades, video game arcades?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And we went there, and we only have a small amount of coins, you know, to go and waste on the machines, right? So because you knew that, you know, you put the coin and you only get like 3 lives, you know, in Pac-Man, right? But because you knew that you only get those 3 chances and then you're out, and you also have a, you know, you have like a quarter more if you miss that one, the game was much more exciting. You know, and you were really sweating and you're trying to go and try to avoid the ghosts, right? And if you managed to beat the game, it was, yeah! But nowadays, I have an Xbox, right? And I have video games that if I lose, I know that I can restart the game virtually endlessly.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you, man, it's not the same excitement. You know, it's kind of reassuring in a way, like, sure, oh, man, thank God that I saved that before I died because this game is tough. But at the same time, you know, it's like, well, you know, I'm tired of it. I'll continue tomorrow. You know, on the arcade, it was like, you know, it was so intense because of that scarcity.
Yeah, it was like an experience.
Yeah.
And now it's like entertainment. It's a completely different, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, people don't go out anymore anyway, so it's they're preparing us for that world. We're walking down the street as a terrifying act.
Yeah, that's true.
It's scary. Yeah, but I think if I had the choice, I would choose to just die rather than be put into a, because like you were talking about life extension, I guess that's okay. I'm not necessarily against that per se. But it's funny because it's like you were saying how they've extended the lifespan of people. And then it catches back to what we were talking about earlier, where it's like that's why they have to have the robots to wipe the grandma's asses. So it's like, it's not to get conspiratorial, but it's like that, you know, it's kind of like The Matrix, like your movie The Matrix there that you love so much. It's like the people are kind of batteries in a way, the old people, just for the robots for the companies to keep making robots. It's like, all right, this is, you know.
That's a good analogy, too. Yeah,
it gets into like a creepy territory, but I think if I had the choice, I was kind of talking about in a sense where they just put you in a computer. It's like, what's the point of living forever in a computer? It's like, I think I'd roll the dice. I think I'd roll the dice and be like, you know what? Just unplug the computer. I want to see what happens next. I don't want to like hang around, you know, in a computer.
I want to, I don't know. I mean, I don't have any illusions of living forever or to, you know, be 100, you know. I hope that I manage to stay, you know, autonomous for most of my life. You know what I mean? That I manage to care for myself, that, you know, I have still have my whatever mental faculties I still have right now that will be remembered to remember my name, whether I had breakfast or not, you know, that day, and that I managed to go to the bathroom by myself. You know, if I have that, you know, then I'm golden. You know, I guess I'm not scared of death, but I am scared. I think that we're all scared of that decay, right? Of that, you know, fading out, because it is the ultimate stigma in our society, you know, to be old.
Yeah. But well, it's weird. As more, I guess it's probably more just like a personal perspective. It feels like as more people get old, it becomes cooler to be old. But maybe that's just because I'm getting old.
I agree. And it's weird because, you know, like the 50s are like the new 30s, you know.
Yeah, it's
and that,
I hope
that's
so.
Not what I think.
Yeah. I know. It seems like there's a rebirth at 40 now. Where before
it will be cool to regain that respect for our elders. You know, the idea of the old man in the village is the wisest and is the guy we really have to pay attention when he says something. You know,
yeah.
Because those are the guys who have, you know, there's a difference between knowledge and wisdom. And wisdom is knowledge that is paired with experience. And experience is only gained through life.
Yeah, exactly. So I think that'll be a conundrum maybe other people will have to face, hopefully not us, where it's like, do you want to be put in the computer or, you know, because
What if we already are in a computer?
That's the thing. I was thinking of that as I was, like, ranting, where in a sense where it's like, what if being in the computer is almost exactly like what it's like right now? Then I don't know, maybe I'd be torn. Maybe I'd be like, well, shit. It's like we invent reincarnation, but instead of some kind of like alchemical process, let's say, for lack of a better term, we can't explain it, some kind of scientific, let's say, reincarnation. Maybe we just invent our own, where we're like, all right, now we put you in a computer and we start you over from from your birth. Who knows?
I don't know. I mean, one of the reasons why I chose the moniker Red Pill Junkie is because, in a way, I discovered that I am something of a Gnostic, you know? I have a very Gnostic view about all of these things, right? And the main idea about Gnosticism is that reality is an illusion. That, like I said, that this world is a tiny subset of a bigger reality. And what is the common thing that we keep hearing from people who have experienced near death that managed to come back from it? I mean, all the themes have kind of varied. It's very, excuse me, very personal, and it's very, you know, some people experience the tunnel of light, some people experience seeing their body from above, or seeing entities, you know, around them. You know, people they might have known during their lifetime, you know, relatives that have passed away, or the typical, you know, angelical, in quotes, beings that, you know, can transport them to the other side, psychopomps. Those kind of themes tend to vary, but one commonality is that these people claim that the near-death experience feels more real than reality. It's like this reality is a YouTube video in 720p, whereas, you know, you flatline and you go to the other side and you experience, you know, the 4K video, you know, a 4K experience.
Yeah.
So that to me, in a way, tells me that, yeah, this is a simulation or this is a limited experience in comparison to what expects us on the other side.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think so. Yeah. It's a strange, strange world, man.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because we're going through all these weird growing pains, but there's some kind of other intelligence out there that's that we're mm-hmm. interacting with on a limited basis that I find very perplexing. And I know your bailiwick is kind of UFOs, but I guess where are you at on that nowadays? What are your thoughts on sort of like, because I know you wrote a piece and you got to interview Jacques Vallée, and for me that was like a transformative experience, and
mm-hmm.
you know, I'm just sort of wondering, like, where's your head at on this UFO issue? Because I think you're a lot like me in the sense where I think it's a lot more complex than just like aliens.
Yeah, well, it's like you know what we're saying right now, and I think that Vallée kind of like goes into the same thinking that he accepted as much, or he, you know, acknowledged it as much when he was interviewed by George Knapp on Coast to Coast not too long ago, I think 2 months ago, something like that. The idea that he thinks that UFOs comes from another aspect of existence that is a higher or a superior level than our own, you know, then you can view that as an ancient Gnostic and say, and yeah, well, maybe the aliens are archons, you know, that they're kind of like demons that come here to toy with us. Or you can go, you know, Matrix side and say, yeah, the aliens are agents, you know, they are maintaining the simulation, or, you know, interacting with us from time to time because they have to deal with stuff.
Yeah,
or,
like the IT,
you know,
guys.
I think that those are all metaphors, I believe. I think it's us trying to grasp with something that is probably incomprehensible to our limited meat brains that operate just in 3 or 4 dimensions and that are getting information only through 5, maybe 6 very, very limited senses, you know. I think that everything we could come up with to try to explain the UFO phenomenon will always remain a very rough and crude approximation of the real deal, you know. And it's kind of like fish in a fish tank trying to understand the nature of the beings that care for them and, you know, that put the lights on and off and sprinkle food from time to time, you know,
yeah.
And sometimes it snatches one of them with a net, you know, and the fish are trying to say, oh my God, what happened to Bob, you know? Oh, was snatched by the net. What did he do, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's intriguing. Part of me wonders if we'll... I think there's like this weird chance too, where I still hold out hope sort of for like a simple answer, in a sense where I think like there's a chance that we could interact with aliens, that could be, but there's something even bigger going on, I guess is what I'm
sure.
thinking too, you know, where it's like there's a part of me that still holds a candle for the ETH and still kind of like thinks imposing human nature on the aliens, where it's like, of course they would come, you know, it's human nature to explore. So it's like, of course they, but I think there's some, I think what a lot of people who've looked at this for a long time kind of realize is like, there's an all of the above quality to this that's far more complex than just the possibility that it's aliens. Like, that's just one small facet of it.
Yeah. You know, I mean, if we trying to go from simple to complicated, well, maybe let's entertain the idea of the ancient civilizations that did manage to attain extremely advanced levels of technology. You know, they managed to build flying saucers and shit, and maybe they did something wrong. Maybe they bombed Mars and blew up Planet X, whatever. And they decided to go to another place or to hide themselves, you know, beneath the the surface of the earth, you know, until things cool off for a while.
Yeah.
But the idea of thinking that those people will remain Homo sapiens indefinitely is kind of ludicrous, you know. I mean, we're seeing it right now, you know. We're talking about the singularity and all those things, but I think that all of these ideas and fears are an echo of something that may be happening right now to the human race, the idea that we are approaching some kind of like crux in our evolution, you know, and from there on is, you know, it's totally different from what was before that. It's kind of like going from a cockroach to a human being in like just one day, you know. And from that perspective, you know, the intelligence behind the UFO phenomenon will be always be incomprehensible, but maybe they weren't incomprehensible in their beginnings. Maybe they had the same beginnings as we had. You know, maybe they began their origins as beings that are constrained by time and space, but they managed to grow out of it, attain nirvana, if you will. You know?
Yeah,
and nirvana means, you know, just self-realization. It's waking up. You know, the Buddha, people say, are you a god? And say, no, I'm just awake. And it doesn't mean that the Buddha was, you know, like shining rays out of his forehead, or didn't need to, you know, eat. In fact, you know, the Buddha died because of food poisoning. You know, interestingly enough. But it was this level of consciousness that seems to be so far away of our normal waking awareness that it will be yet like from going to the perception of an amoeba to, you know, someone who, you know, can see in infrared.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Remember, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more.